Chris, thank you very much for that really super introduction. I think it set the stage for the comments that I'm going to make. GSK, just to put in context what the work that we're doing at GSK on Ebola, it's important to understand that GSK, before May of 2013, had nothing in the context of Ebola vaccines. And the only reason that we had something in 2014 was that we purchased a small Italian-Swiss biotech that happened in its portfolio, and it wasn't the reason we bought them, that happened to be working with the NIH on a vaccine candidate that had gone through a series of studies in non-human primates, and they had some promising data showing that you could protect non-human primates from a very highly lethal challenge with a single dose of the vaccine. And as we became aware of the epidemic in March, along with the rest of the world, we felt that there was potentially something that we could do here. And I'm not going to belabor this, but it was very hard to get any traction with WHO or others to think about the role of a vaccine, albeit in a very early stage of development, in the context of this outbreak. Finally, then, of course, in August, when the public health emergency was called, things really got moved forward. And what I would want to talk about, and I've broken my talk up into five chapters, are five different areas, and just a few key thoughts, and I'm sure they will stimulate some discussion. I think that was the intent of this. The first one is called The Power of Partnership. And as Chris has alluded to, there was no way we could have done what we've done, we and the vaccine community, because we're not the only ones who are making and trying to develop an Ebola vaccine. This could not have been done by industry by itself. The timeline for us, and of course, the first case was detected in December, in August, and this is the big gap. And this what didn't happen here really had a big spin-on effect of everything else that happened in terms of our ability to respond quickly. But by August, when WHO declared the Ebola health emergency, we were asked, what can you do to accelerate this vaccine development? Now, the fact that we hadn't gotten traction didn't mean we weren't thinking about it internally. In fact, we had a plan. We said, if we get the go, we'll do this, 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 and this. And so when we were called by WHO to do something, we immediately got on the phone. I called Adrian Hill at Oxford. I called my colleagues at the NIH, worked with the folks at WHO, and we put, in a matter of days, a plan to run a series of clinical trials. And there was tremendous response from the FDA. We're able to turn around an IND. The plan for that IND was to have it submitted in December and the first trial to start in March of 2015. They received the IND on September 1st and approved it in 48 hours. That has never happened before, and it's an example of what can be done when people are focused on a specific thing. So that allowed us to start the first clinical trials in September. First at the NIH, we got the NIH with their product that they had spent 10 years working on in this area, the GSK vaccine being the last rendition of it, to ship those vaccine vials before they even had data to Oxford so that we could start studies there, to Lausanne so we could start expanded studies in Geneva, and to Mali so that we could get data in West Africans that would provide some safety data and help us select a dose for the next step of the piece of the work. And so by November, we knew that we actually had a vaccine candidate because we had safety data and we saw immune responses that were very promising. And in fact, by the first week of January, we were able to say, this is the dose we're going to use in the phase 3 protocols. And in the process of this, of course, working with the NIH, working with the CDC, working with WHO, helping to develop protocols, some of which we're not even involved with now, but the community coming together to work on the right study designs and to figure out how we're going to do this, in parallel, taking a whole bunch of people that were doing other projects and having them focus on nothing but learning how to make this Ebola vaccine. This was a new platform technology for GSK. We had 175 people, and they're still today working on figuring out how to make large numbers of these doses. So this is the kind of response that it took for us to be able to at least to be able to go to Liberia, provide doses, and we were able to do this in the first week of February, start a phase three trial. This is a process that normally takes 6, 7, 10 years, and we did it in a few months. So this could not have been done outside of the context of this partnership. And as I said, we have experienced a number of development programs where partnership has been important. I've worked most of my career in malaria, and this is a great example of where we've had tremendous partnerships. They make for good science, shared risks, and more efficient development of new medicines and vaccines. And by tapping into this existing network of scientists, investigators, funders, the Wellcome Trust, DFID, MRC came, they were very responsive and helped support these clinical trials, helped purchase some of the initial lots of vaccine for the clinical trials, really helped us accelerate the program. And with the help of WHO, we were able to engage the regulators so that we could get these approvals, protocols approved, and a process that was agreed and with agreed timelines. If you think going through the EMA and the FDA is slow, going through the national regulatory agencies in developing countries is much slower. 6 months is a short time. We were able to turn this around into a matter of weeks. So I think there's a very positive message that came out of this, and that there's a way to do things better. And I just listed the logos here of all the organizations that have helped us. And, of course, there's many others that have helped the other groups as well. But thank you very much, particularly those from the UK who have been so supportive of this program. My second chapter, the problem with predictions. Now, we've heard the importance of good epidemiology and predictions and modeling, but it has a downside too. This, when we saw these predictions, these were predictions that were discussed at one of the first WHO meetings where industry leaders from the countries, the NIH, the CDC, really everybody who was touching this came to WHO to talk about, in the area of vaccines, what can we do and what should we do. And the presentation was given with essentially the message that if it goes like what we're seeing, we're talking about the depopulation of West Africa by April 2015. It was incredibly sobering. And I think it definitely allowed people to focus the discussion. But I'm not sure that it was optimal for rational decision-making and planning on some aspects. Because I think that this scenario predictions in some way contributed to a sense of desperation which blocked normal scientific debate, especially around study designs. And in particular, there was huge pushback for the idea that we could conduct randomized controlled trials of vaccines. There was the regulators pleaded with the community that this is the only way we're going to know whether these vaccines actually work, or to do randomized controlled trials. And yet, Even though the ethical perspectives, the ethicists were there and said, there's no problem with this, we had tremendous pushback. And in fact, two of the three phase three trials that are being carried out are not randomized controlled trials. Chapter three, the perils of promises. When we attended this WHO meeting, we were encouraged to bring our company secrets, essentially open the kimono and tell us what you can do. And this required huge and high-risk projections of the numbers of doses that GSK might be able to do if everything went perfectly, projecting out a year, given that we ourselves had never made one dose of this vaccine at the time we were making these projections. And these were provided in confidence to the WHO. Within 24 hours, they were in Science. And, of course, that puts tremendous pressure on the organization. And, frankly, if you look at these numbers, we're not really able to generate the numbers of doses that are on here. We're going to get there, but not at the speed this was out there. So this put a lot of pressure on the organization and continues to put pressure on the organization in terms of being able to deliver on promises. At the same meeting, there were several analyses laid out around the complexity of the regulatory and liability issues, and the UK government argue that there is a need to provide some form of relief of liability for the producers and distributors of the vaccines. Now, high-level talks have been held with governments on the issue of loss mitigation, not only due to resources diverted to fight Ebola, but also for indemnification against claims that might be brought by trial participants, given the very early stage of the Ebola program and the development aspects of the vaccine itself. And we continue to invest without concrete mitigation plan, and we've had to acquire expensive supplementary trial insurance using our own resources. The U.S. government stepped up with the PREP Act, and it's essential that government provide the incentive to ensure that industry continues to step up in future emergencies. Chapter 4, Policy and Perception. There was collective failure of global governance as the scale and the nature of this humanitarian crisis unfolded. Chris alluded to this gap, six-month gap between April and August. By being fully focused on the traditional pillars of case identification, case isolation, and contract tracing, the wrong signals were sent to industry. Consider what could have been done if we'd had a six-month lead. Stronger surveillance and detection systems coupled with better coordination and decision-making could go a long way to making a better, being better prepared for the next public health emergency of international concern, the PHIC. Chapter 5, Prepare or Perish. Over the last decade, the world has encountered a series of global health emergencies for which we were unprepared: H5N1, SARS, H1N1, MERS, and now Ebola. What will the next one be? All of these threats have one thing in common. They are zoonotic diseases that jump from animal reservoirs to humans. There are many more that we know about and probably others that we don't know about, and we're not prepared to respond to them. We have a major opportunity to make a substantial change because of the focus created by Ebola, but it will take vision, political leadership, and a rethinking of how we address this class of infectious disease threats, and we must seize the opportunity to do this. And these are some ideas that we'd like to throw out for discussion. Create a global institution dedicated to surveillance and basic research on agreed, prioritized emerging disease threats. Create dedicated R&D units embedded in an industrial setting to focus on developing drugs, vaccines, and diagnostics for priority pathogens. And we say embedded in industry because that's where the tools and knowledge and know-how to actually do this are. Establish mid-scale manufacturing capacity for lower volume stockpiles, a network of manufacturing capacity across the world for mass production, and create a payment system to ensure that supplies are available when and where they are needed. And finally, to create a legal framework for indemnification, agree an acceptable clinical development approach that can work under outbreak conditions, in other words, preparing the ethical and regulatory framework and having the capacity in developing countries to do research, and new regulatory pathways for approval of the tools the world will need to respond adequately to future emerging diseases. And I'll stop there. Thank you very much.